It is Friday, March the 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. diplomats expelled from Russia after Washington sided with Britain on poisoning of a former Russian spy.
The United States is one with the U.K. This is a show of solidarity. This is a commitment to our closest ally and friend.
Also ahead, Palestinian protests get underway today near the Israeli-Gaza border, the Pope washing the feet of prisoners on Holy Thursday, and the sounds of Nora Jones. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russia expelled 60 U.S. diplomats on Thursday and announced it would eject scores from other countries that have joined London and Washington in censuring Moscow over the poisoning of a spy. The expulsions precisely mirrored steps taken by Western governments against Russian diplomats and appeared to show Russia was not seeking to escalate the standoff over the nerve agent poisoning of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the British city of Salisbury on March the 4th. VOA's Jamie Detmer asked the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, John Huntsman, if this might be an endpoint of the tensions regarding the poisoning.
Well, it depends on how you define the endpoint. If the endpoint is Russia acting more responsibly with respect to its commitment to undertakings, agreements in international institutions, its very presence in the United Nations on the Perm 5, for example. What is its commitment there to things like chemical weapons, where five times they voted against investigating chemical weapons abuses in Syria? So there are some broader, longer-term issues about where this goes and what a successful outcome might be. But clearly a successful outcome would be Russia that steps back from its malign activity and becomes a responsible partner.
Why did the U.S. decide to believe the British case on this? I mean, what's been publicly laid out by Theresa May is intent and capability. Is there more information, intelligence information, that's been shared with the Americans, which would indicate that there was some kind of Russian state sanctioning of the poisoning? And if there has been, should that be more widely shared to convince doubters?
Well, you don't just decide to believe. We're growing up mature democracies. We have robust civil society. We're open, transparent countries, both the United States and the UK. So it's not like you can conduct an investigation without a lot of very interested and probing eyes following the case the entire way. So that's the environment in which we're operating. Straight up professional. The burden is on the UK to look at the case, to investigate it, and to come up with their results. And of course, there's been some close sharing of information. That's the way these things go with the security services. That's how you would want it to be. And you read in the papers a little bit about what is going on, and I suspect, as with in life in any democracy or transparent society, we'll learn a lot more. The citizens will learn a lot more as we go forward. I suspect that that will be the case. But the United States is one with the UK. This is a show of solidarity. This is a commitment to our closest ally and friend. And it would be saying something horrific if we were to do nothing in the face of what we do know, and given our longstanding friendship and alliance with the UK. That's not how America would want to respond.
Did the Russian officials you talked to show any surprise the decision by the U.S. to expel, 60 Russian diplomats, when it came so shortly after a telephone call from President Trump to President Putin congratulating him on the election?
Well, you can never stage or time things perfectly. You have to, there's a rhythm to the world and it's not exactly predictable. And you have to use the tools that you have at your disposal in responding. I will tell you, as long as I've discussed Russia with the president, which goes back to when he sat me down and asked me to take this job, he's been very consistent about wanting to engage, notwithstanding our challenges. his desire to engage and to keep a dialogue alive and well. He's also laid it out to me in pretty plain terms that he expects any kind of engagement and meetings at the head of state level to be based on progress on the issues that matter most. Coming from the private sector, and I've worked for many presidents, Republican and Democrat, he's a results-oriented person. He wants to know where we're going, what's been done, what kind of progress, for example, on Ukraine and issues like that. He's very much into the results and where the relationship overall is heading based upon the very real and important issues we confront together.
That is U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Huntsman speaking with VOA's Jamie Detmer.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Israeli security forces are bracing for an extended period of protests beginning today along its tense border with Gaza. Thousands of Palestinians expected to answer the call to gather in tent cities demanding the right of return for Palestinian refugees to what is now Israel. Well, the start of the demonstration is symbolically linked to the so-called Land Day, when six Israeli Arabs were killed by security forces over a land confiscation in 1976. This year's protest is expected to last until May 15th, that's Israel's 70th anniversary, known to Palestinians as Nakba or Catastrophe. The Israeli military's chief of staff says more than 100 sharpshooters will be deployed and they have permission to open fire if lives are in danger. But an Israeli cabinet official insisted that Israel will try to use minimum force to prevent any casualties. Guy Ziv is a Middle East scholar at American University's School of International Service. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Palestinian residents of Gaza have much to be concerned about.
As you know, the negotiations, so-called peace process, has been at a standstill since 4 years ago. The parties have just hardened their positions. The Trump administration is not really making a concerted effort to woo the Palestinians. And certainly what did not help was the embassy relocation decision. So this is kind of an opportunity to demonstrate their disaffection, their frustrations, their dire situation in Gaza. They want to really highlight the plight of the Palestinian refugees.
The military chief of staff told an Israeli newspaper that the military would not allow mass infiltration or tolerate damage to the barrier during these protests, which I understand could last weeks.
Keep in mind that over the past week, there have been several Palestinians who have infiltrated the border. They took knives and, in a couple of cases, grenades, and cut through the border. This is something that is of major concern to the IDF that wants to maintain security. The idea is, if you had a few infiltrators already, how are you going to prevent hundreds, potentially thousands of protesters or demonstrators from infiltrating?
An Israeli cabinet minister speaking on Israel radio said Hamas has avoided direct conflict with Israel since the end of the 2014 Gaza war, but he said pressure Hamas is now feeling from Israel's destruction of some of its network of attack tunnels near the border, coupled with harsh economic conditions in Gaza, are a formula for rising tension.
Well, there's no question that the situation in Gaza is dire. Gaza is an open-air prison. Hamas does bear some responsibility for that because Hamas governs Gaza and has spent much of its resources constructing these terror tunnels. Hamas has redoubled its efforts to rebuild these tunnels, and they clearly do not have peaceful purposes in mind. There is frustration on their part. The economy there is not doing well, and people are not getting electricity every day. So the situation, there's no question the situation is dire. But Hamas has concluded that it is not in its interest to have all-out war with Israel, despite the tensions, because Hamas has a lot to lose, not just Israel. But at the same time, they do have their own internal pressures, and they feel the need to respond to Israel. And of course, Israel feels the need to respond to Hamas whenever there are rockets that land in a southern city. And then, of course, the infiltrators themselves.
That is Guy Ziv, a Middle East scholar at American University, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis marked Holy Thursday washing the feet of 12 inmates in a central Rome prison. He also celebrated the traditional Mass, urging priests to be spiritually close to their flocks and not to insist on preaching laws. We get more now from Sabina Castelfranco in Rome.
Since the start of his pontificate 5 years ago, Pope Francis decided to celebrate the Mass of our Lord's Supper on Holy Thursday outside the Vatican. In the past, he has gone to detention centers and a home for the disabled to wash the feet of prisoners, refugees, and other marginalized people. This is a tradition that Pope Francis began as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, where he would regularly mark the Holy Thursday liturgy in local jails. At the prison, the Pope also greeted inmates and visited those who were sick inside the prison's infirmary. In the morning, the Pope celebrated the traditional Chrism Mass in St. Peter's Basilica. As Holy Thursday was the day Jesus shared his priesthood with the apostles, Pope Francis led the many priests, bishops, and cardinals present in a renewal of their priestly vows. Pope Francis also blessed the oils that will be used in the sacraments of baptism, confirmation, ordination, and the anointing of the sick throughout the year. In a lengthy homily, Pope Francis urged priests to be close to their people, calling proximity the key to mercy and truth.
Egli avrebbe potuto perfettamente essere uno scriba o un dottore della legge.
Jesus, the Pope said, could have been a scribe or a doctor of the law, but he wanted to be an evangelizer, a street preacher, the bearer of joyful news for his people. The Pope told priests all over the world, closeness is crucial for an evangelizer because it is a key attitude in the gospel. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
One year ago today, a dear colleague passed away. In speaking with my colleagues, I thought it would be a good idea to remember Dave DeForest, who worked tirelessly to bring you the news with the ultimate in professionalism and with a great deal of humanity. He was a friend to us all, and I must say, one of the best people I've ever known. Just as a reminder of how great Dave always sounded, here is a sample of a promotional announcement he did for VOA News.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
That's the very professionalism I was talking about. It always left me in awe, and I must say with a heavy heart that I miss our colleague, Dave DeForest, very much. Thank you. And now we're joined by VOA's Doug Bernard for what's trending on social media today. What you got, Doug?
Well, today, like any other day, people are still complaining about politics. They're worried about economics, debating about foreign policy and international relations, all the kind of normal stuff. But today's a bit of a special day in the United States. It is the opening day, or just opening day, of the Major League Baseball season. Now, I don't think that baseball as a sport, occupies the same place that it did in the United States, not in U.S. sort of civic life, that it did 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago. But it still occupies a very important place in many people's lives. And I think opening day is not just a celebration of, the start of the baseball season that's going to carry us right down into October, but it's really in some ways, because it's so closely associated with the start of spring, it's just kind of a hopeful day. And people are, I'm not going to read the tweets because they're all pretty much the same. People basically just, kind of tweeting on their team, supporting their team. Twitter, for example, has, if you use hashtag opening day, your site, your tweets get posted with this red, white, and blue bunting, kind of old-fashioned bunting that, you might maybe used to see at ballparks in the old day. Maybe you still do. I don't know. And every time you use the team's hashtag, like STL, hashtag STL for St. Louis or something, they'll pop up a little icon of your team as well. So people, I think, really kind of just saying, yes, here we go, being filled in a moment of hope. And that's kind of what spring is in a certain way. And, at the end of the day, it's just kind of nice to see a little hope and a little optimism on Twitter.
Indeed. Many thanks, Doug. That's VOA's Doug Bernard. Bernard, I must say, I watched the Houston Astros, last year's World Series winner. They beat the Texas Rangers 4-1. Quite a great opening day game for those teams. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Affordable housing in expensive Hong Kong, but in a tube, a concrete tube, that is. Architect James Law coming up with the idea of OPOD tube housing equipped with a living room and a bathroom.
One day I happened to see some of these large concrete water tubes left, and I thought, wow, why are they being wasted?
Inside is a microwave, a couch that folds to a bed, a closet, a small fridge, even some shelves. Livable, but minimal. Law says the 2.5 meter wide circular apartment is really designed to be rented to young people.
What we intend to do is have a rental program that is significantly cheaper than the existing rates in Hong Kong.
The OPODs rent for 3,000 Hong Kong dollars a month compared to the average 15,000 a month for the same amount of space. Law's idea is to place these pipe homes on buildings, under bridges, or between structures. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now let's have a little something from the world of music.
Come away with me. Come away with me, and I will write you a song.
Norah Jones is an American singer and songwriter. Billboard magazine named her the top jazz artist of the 2000 to 2009 decade, and she's won 9 Grammy Awards.
With their lies, and I want to walk with you on a cloudy day in fields where the yellow grass grows knee high,
So won't you try to come away with me, and we'll kiss on a mountain top. Come away with me, and I'll never stop loving you.
Nora Jones was born Jitali Nora Shankar on March 30, 1979, the daughter of renowned Indian sitar player and composer Ravi Shankar and American concert producer Sue Jones. She launched her solo career in 2002 with the release of Come Away With Me, a commercially successful and critically acclaimed album that was a fusion of jazz with country music and pop. After her parents divorced in 1986, Nora Jones moved to the U.S. state of Texas with her mother, and that's where she grew up. Then headed to New York, where the songs she wrote and sang became bestsellers, songs like Chasing Pirates.
In your message you say, so I turned out the light. And I don't know how to slow it down. My mind's racing from chasing pirates. Now an ambulance screams while the silliest thing
Jones has collaborated with some of the best songwriters in the business, including Jesse Harris. His song, Don't Know Why, became the second single by Jones from her debut studio album. It peaked at number 30 on the Billboard Hot 100 and was a critical success.
You by the house of fun. I don't know why I didn't come. I don't know why I didn't come.
After a period of estrangement from her father, Ravi Shankar, Jones traveled to India to spend time with him and wrote some of the material she plays even today on her many tours. Ravi Shankar died in 2012. And in 2014, Nora Jones had her first child with her musician husband, who she says wishes to remain anonymous. They had a second child in 2016. Jones is known for being extremely private about her personal life, preferring to spend time with family and simply writing and singing songs. So many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. The latest world news, I tell you, is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned for what's happening there. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Nora Jones.
Don't know why I didn't call. My feel as empty as a drum. I don't know why I didn't call. My don't know why I didn't call. I don't know why I didn't.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Angola is one of the world's most heavily mined countries. Decades of fighting for independence, followed by a quarter century of civil war that ended in 2002, left the country in tatters and heavily sown with landmines. During the civil war, both sides liberally deployed landmines to protect military bases, key infrastructure and troop billets, and to control the population's movement. Benguela Province is one of the country's most mine-affected regions. Half the population lives in rural areas, where the vast majority of explosive remnants of war are found. It is one of the reasons why development has stagnated there. Unemployment is high. Some 94% of the population lives on less than $5 per day, with 67% surviving on less than $2 per day. Halo Trust, a non-political and non-religious British charity and American non-profit organization which specializes in removal of debris left behind by war, has found a way to address both these issues and more. Its 100 Women in Mining in Angola project, which is supported by the U.S. Department of State, trains and employs women deminers to clear some of the most dangerous minefields in the country. Ultimately, the project assists in creating safe spaces for rural development that benefit Benguela's mine-impacted populations. But the program's benefits reach far beyond clearing the land of mines. The work teaches the women new skills, provides them with income, and empowers them. The project specifically promotes gender equality in employment, offering women opportunities in geographical areas and sectors of the economy that have traditionally been male-dominated. All positions at all levels are open to the women, ranging from basic manual demining to logistic, medical, and technical support personnel, team leaders, minefield supervisors, and a provincial operations manager to oversee the entire operation. As the majority of the recruits come from the local districts, the project allows them to take a central role in the stabilization and development of their home communities. When local women have a say in how mine clearance operations are conducted, they have a chance to be involved in shaping outcomes for themselves, their families, their communities, and their country as a whole.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.